Thought he was going to say more than that. Thank you, Joe. Help me, Mark, excuse me. I'm a real alcoholic. My name's Bob McKinney. Hi, everybody. Hi. It's good. It's good to be above ground, vertical, and breathing in Atlanta, Georgia on a Sunday morning. And it's good to see this crowd out here this morning. You know, it's. Before I get started here, I want to say my thank yous to the committee for asking me to come down and share my experience, strength, and hope. And it's always a pleasure. Anytime I'm asked to do something in a program, Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always try to say yes. But before I get started in my talk, there's a special lady in this room today that for 23 years, she's gone one day at a time without taking a drink. And I'd like to just, let's give Ms. Tony C. A round of applause. Tony. The reason I know that it's her birthday because she told me last night and she asked me to mention it, so I just I'd like to thank the other speakers who's gone before me. I'm sorry, Michael, I didn't get here for your talk on Friday night. I was in the airport in Newark, New Jersey, and that flight was 3 hours late, and I got to tell you, I thought God had removed one of my character defects, but I'm here to tell you, and get complete honest with you, I just don't wait gracefully, and that flight was 3 hours late, and I'm sorry I missed your talk. But Michael and I have been doing this thing together now, I don't know, since South Nebraska a few years ago, and she's got a great message, and then there was Sandy, and Sandy, what a great talk. I would just like to recommend something to you. Next time you get up here, tell us how you feel, please. I really appreciate what you said about the Andrew. You know, a lot of speakers don't have the guts to say that, sweetheart, and I appreciate that, because when I introduce myself to as somebody other than an alcoholic, that sets me apart, and that's all I am, is an alcoholic. Thank you for saying that. Then there's the Al-Anon. Joanne, I think, I don't know whether she's here or not, but you know, what a message. You know, whenever I listen to Al-Anon share their experience, strength, and hope, and all the agony and the pain they go to get through here, I just always want to jump up in the audience and say, hell, take a drink, you know. God, you don't need to go through that, you know. And then there was CD. God, you know, CD sort of like E.F. Hutton when he speaks, everybody listens. And what a message. And then I've had a chance to spend some time with Joe and my dear friends from Greenville, my AA mom's here, Maggie. And between Maggie and Betty and Joe from Greenville, they got about 100 years of sobriety. And I know they came down here to keep me honest. And I appreciate them and I love them. And a young man I sponsored from Savannah, Georgia, came up and surprised me, and his name's Joe, and he's just an inspiration to me. He's got a lot of years, and he's good. He brought me a note. My wife couldn't be with me today, and I apologize for that. She had another commitment in Greenville, but she did send me a note, and I'd like to read it to you. Lib said, to tell you to settle down, you're not that important. You know, if it's a joke there, you're it. Don't, you know. Anybody can do the deal, so she's right, and you know, I'm just grass. You know, and I think about gratitude, and I think about this old gal down in Mississippi. I was at the state convention down there a few years ago, and she talked about gratitude, and she got up, she said, you know, I ain't got but two teeth, but thank God they meet. You know, and I love that, you know, and I don't tell jokes up here because my sponsor says I'm not an entertainer. I just tell true stories, and I know the true stories is because another alcoholic told them. And you know, we know alcoholics don't lie. And I always get nervous before I do one of these deals, you know. And I'm reminded of the story of the guy that was getting ready to tell his story. A young man was getting ready to tell a story for his home group. He just couldn't do it. I mean, he just got petrified. And I mean, you know, he just said, you know, so he went to a sponsor, and he's got a sponsor like me, you know, knows everything about everything, and. He told him, he said, hey, look, it's a trick to it. He says, it's no big deal getting up behind the podium and sharing your experience, the spirit, strength, and hope. He says, you get behind the podium and you look out in the audience, and he says, you pick the dumbest guy in the crowd out and you look at him. And you focus on him all the time you're talking. And he says, I'll promise you, it'll put you at ease and you'll be able to share, and it'll go just fine. And of course the guy said, will it really work? And he says, I promise you it worked, because you know sponsors don't lie. And so he said, okay. So he got up before his home group, and gosh, he was so nervous. And I mean, he just, all he could do was just say his name, you know. And all of a sudden, he looked out in the audience, and they sat, the dumbest looking guy in the world. And he looked at him, and the guy looked at him, and all of a sudden, man, he started telling his story, and he looked at him all day, all night long, and it just flowed, man. I mean, it was just wonderful, you know. And he got through sharing his story, you know, and people clapped, and they came up and told him what a great job he did. And about that time, the guy he looked at all night long came running up to him and cold-cocked him and knocked him flat off his back. And he said, the guy jumped up, and he said, what'd you do that for? He said, was it that bad? He said, heck no, me and you got the same sponsor. So, Buckwheat, if I'm looking at you, bud, don't take it personally, okay, bud? It's good to be here tonight, and I'm charged with the responsibility to share with you a little bit about what I was like, and what I'm like, and what happened to me, and what I'm trying to be like today. And I used to get up behind this podium, and I'd say, I'd like to tell you what it was like, you know. And my sponsor reminded me that it never changes, that I do, you know, and he's right. And I'd like to tell you that I'm a good member of standing of the New Beginnings Group in Greenville, South Carolina. We meet on Mondays and Friday nights. And if you're ever in Greenville, please stop by. We'll put you behind the podium on Monday night if you just happen to be coming through, because we believe in speaker meetings. And the reason we believe in speaker meetings is because I went to my sponsor one time, and we were going to form a new group. And I said, we're going to have a discussion meetings. And he said, well, what are you going to discuss? And I told him, well, you know, issues and things like that. And he said, no, I don't think you need to do that. He says, you need to have a speaker meeting. And I said, well, we prefer discussion meetings. And he said, well, look, he said, let me ask you something. He said, how many conferences have you been to? And I said, well, I've been to a couple of conferences. He said, what do they do on Friday night? He said, did they get 600 or 700 people in a room and break into 5 discussion meetings? I said, no. He said, well, what do you think they get speakers from? And I thought for a few minutes, and being the smart aleck I am, and I said, well, I think they're all trained in California. He said, no, you get speaker meetings by having speakers from having speaker meetings. And he said, by the way, he says, when you get somebody that's ready to share their experience, strength, and hope, after about a year, year and a half, he says, what do you take them to share their story if you don't have, your group doesn't have speaker meetings? So we have speaker meetings in Greenville at New Beginnings every Monday night, 8 o'clock. So if you ever happen to come through, we'll put you behind the podium. Because he tells me it's part of my responsibility of being an active member of the program of Fellowship of Alcoholics and Mine for me to sit down and shut up and listen to your miracle. See? Because, you see, I like to talk about me. Me being up here today, I'm talking about my favorite subject, me. You know, if Alcoholic ever had a theme song, it's I've Always Got Me on My Mind. You know, I ain't much, but I'm all I think about, I'll tell you that. And we have good discussion meetings on Friday nights, and they all come out of the book. And I'm serious about that. We have a good group up there, and I'd like to welcome you. I do have a sponsor, and I think it's important. A lot of the speakers have mentioned that before, to have a sponsor, and I do have one. I had the same sponsor since I've been in the program for about 13 years. I got him after a year I was in the program, because, see, I didn't need a sponsor that first year and a half. I was just trying to figure out, you know, if I was going to stay in this deal or not. I looked around for the first year to find somebody that was good enough for me, you know. And I found I made a big mistake after 14 months and asked Sterling Fletcher Watts III to be my sponsor, and we've been walking this path together ever since. My sobriety date, September 17th, 1983, and by God's grace and you people and this fellowship, I hadn't found it necessary to take a drink. For that, I'm ever grateful. You know, I don't know. I've heard a lot of people stand behind this podium, and they talked about how they were different, you know. And I guess I'm no, you know. I'm told that I suffer from a disease of perception, you know. It's not my point of view. It's just where I'm viewing from. And I realize that, you know. And I think, you know, far back as I can remember, I started feeling different when I was in the third grade. You know, I could have used a drink in the third grade to sort of get me through the rough times, you know, because that's when I looked around and compared what I had and what you had, see. And I looked around and I realized that I didn't have a father. And all the other kids in Manning, South Carolina, where I grew up, they had moms and they had dads and they had nice homes and they had cars in the garage. And I looked at what I had, and I had a mom, I had a small house, and we didn't have cars, see. And I just knew I was different. You know, and I used to have to walk to school in the morning. When I'd walk to school in the morning, they'd stop by in those cars and ask me if I wanted to ride. And I'd say no, because, you see, I was embarrassed, and I knew I was less than. And they'd ask me again, and because I'm a people pleaser, you know, I'd say, yeah, I'll ride. And every time I climbed in the back seat, I just knew I was second class. And I get to school, see, and I was told one time the disease of alcoholism, you know, that we operate with something between our ears that we got the audacity to call a brain, but if you think about it, it's actually a crippled instrument, see, because, see, I do things and I react and I see things different. And when I'd get to school, and Ms. Gertrude Reapy got up in the third grade, when I was in the third grade, and she said, "We got an extra kid in here, and they got to leave. We got too many students." I knew she was talking about me. Now, I don't know why, I just felt that way. I've been that way I operate, I think different, I feel different. I was at a meeting in Newark on Friday, and I looked around at all the people in this meeting, and everybody was drinking drinks, and I had drinks other than me, and I had coffee, and I was the only one in there, and I just knew I was different. Now, I never thought about, you know, well, maybe they just don't like coffee at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know? So I'm not, you know, it's just my perception of things. You know, I had two speeds when I was growing up, and I was stopping wide open. I never felt like I was at the right time, at the right place, talking to the right people until I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why I felt that way. I just felt that way. Still messed up today with my thoughts, you know. Lib can send me to the store to get a quart of milk and a loaf of bread, and I'll go buy $100 worth of groceries. I don't know why. She sends me to go buy $100 worth of groceries. I'll come back with a quart of milk and a loaf of bread. That's just the way I see things. I was just, you know, my perception of life, you know. And for some reason, I just knew I was different growing up in that small town. I used to cry a lot when I was a kid. I don't know why, I just did. You know, I kissed my first girl when I was 13 years old. Just busted out crying. Now, I got to tell you, after I started drinking alcohol, I tried to kiss a lot of girls, and most of them started crying. You know? I didn't take my first drink until I was 16, and it's important that I remember this. Me and Calvin and Hal Ray went down to the lake and bought us two six-packs of champagne. I took two. They gave me that second bottle of champagne, and I drank it. And the first bottle I drank, and I sat there, nothing happened. That second bottle did it for me. And you know what it did. See, it took me out of that world of reality and put me into that false world of utopia, and that's where I would want it to be for the next 26 to 28 years of my life. Because, you see, my way of thinking just cleared up, and all of a sudden I was no longer that second-class citizen. I was first class. All of a sudden I was good as they were. All of a sudden I knew I could have what they wanted. I went on and graduated from high school, and I went to college. College never was a problem for me. I went to college for 8 years. You know? Best 3 years of my college career. I was a freshman. So no big deal. I didn't go to get a college education. I went to find her, and we do that. You know, I married her. We were married for 20 years and 2 weeks and had two beautiful kids. See? And see, I always wanted in life, what I always wanted in life, I wanted to have a car with two-car garage, a house with a two-car garage, two kids, two dogs, and a wife, and I did that, and I owned every bit of it, see. I owned my wife, I owned my kids, I owned my car, I owned everything. But see, and I had what they had, I still wasn't happy, because I became a daily drinker early on. See, let me clarify my drink of choice. It was vodka and Gatorade. You know, if you hadn't drank, it's just too bad. You know, that Gatorade just get that glucose in it, and it just gets you there real quick, you know. And I didn't know how to be a father. I didn't know how to be a husband. I didn't know how to be a responsible human being. I didn't know how to be the things that I always wanted to be in life. So I became a daily drinker, and I was one of these kind of drinkers that never did want to come home. You know, I was one of these that could leave and I could come home 2 or 3 days later or a week later. You know, I never respected the institution of marriage. And I don't want to sit up here and give you a long drunken log. I drank for 28 years and did a lot of things that I'm not very proud of. I've had the DUIs, half a dozen, eight, somewhere along there. You know, I've totaled three cars. I've almost killed a 19-year-old kid in a blackout. You know, I've had about 15 or 20 wives, you know, and two of them I've been married to, you know. And I don't tell you that to brag. I just tell you that was my mode of operation, see. I did a lot of things that I'm not proud of, see. And I became a liar and a cheat and a thief early on, and you know that's the way we are, you know. You know, one of our basic principles here is honesty, you know. And I found out in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it says in the 12th step, you know, it says my basic responsibility today is to practice these principles in all my affairs. And when I look at that, I said, okay, what are these principles? And I look at honesty, and I look at, you know, courage, and I look at hope. See, a principle to me is nothing more than a word until I have to put it into action. See, I can tell you I'm honest, but if I'm not threatened to put honesty into action, then I don't know whether I'm honest or not, see? I don't know whether I'm a liar. I don't know whether I'm a cheat until I'm threatened to put that into action. See, I can tell you right now, I got all the faith in the world. I don't know whether I got all the faith in the world, because if I don't have fear, I got the audacity to think I got faith. See, I go to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the reason I go to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is because I don't want to forget. I don't want to forget, see, that what it was before I got here. See, when I talk about, when I think about the fear that I had growing up as a kid and the fear of not being able to cope with life, I realize today that it was just a lack of faith because, see, I didn't have a substitute for this thing called alcohol. And it tells me in the big book that once we quit drinking, we got to find a substitute. And a substitute for me today is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my famous lies that I used to tell is for ones of you who don't know and hadn't heard my story, I used to be a professional football player. And that lie goes like this. I would find these good old boy bars, you know. You know the ones that are about two or three blocks off the beaten track? And I'd slide in at 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, and I'd drag up to the bar, and I'd order my vodka and my Gatorade. If they didn't have Gatorade, I'd just drink the vodka, and I'd have a little fellowship with whoever was there, and they would start crowding in, you know. And finally, a good old boy would look over, and he'd say, "Well, Bob, what do you do?" And I'd say, "Well, since I've retired, I'm a traveling salesman." He says, "A traveling salesman?" He says, "Well, where'd you retire from?" And I said, "Well, I used to be a professional football player." And, man, that gets their attention. They love that, you know. Good old boys love that, you know. And I used to tell that lie to where, you know, I'd get in these certain bars and I'd start telling that lie because, see, I wanted that attention. I wanted to feel a part of. See, I wanted to be like them, you know. I was a wannabe. And I had that lie so down pat, I began to believe it myself. And I can remember one night I was in Atlanta, Georgia, telling that lie on the south side of town over at one of those bars around the airport. And I'm sitting up there lying and I'm telling this old guy sitting on the right of me, you know, and I'm just, man, I got him three deep around that bar. You know, Bob used to play professional football. They'd buy them drinks and I'm buying those drinks and blah, 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 blah. Finally, guy on the other side of me, he said, "Where'd you play?" I said, I played New York Giants. He said, "When?" I said, "Early 60s, 62 through 70, 68, somewhere along there." He got real quiet, you know, and I knew it was getting ready to come down, you know, because my mom always told me, "Boy, they're going to find out about all those lies." He looked over at me and he said, "You know, I lived in New York in 1957 and 1973, and he said, had home season tickets to the New York Giants, and he said, I never missed a game. He said, what position did you play?" And I'm not dumb. I thought real quick, and I said, "Well, I was a defensive back." And it got as quiet as it is in this room right here. And he looked over and he said, "You know, I was there Sunday afternoon. You intercepted a pass and ran it back for a touchdown." Now, I looked at him and he looked at me and he knew I was lying, but I'll tell you what, that old boy drank free the rest of the night. So help me God. As God is my witness, I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Greenville, South Carolina, and this guy, his name was Ken, was sitting across the room from us, and he punched a guy next to him, and he said, "You see old Bob over there?" The guy said, "Yeah." He said, "He's played professional football." It's sort of hard to take that tenth step in front of your home group, but you have to do it. But I was one of these drinkers, you know, that I knew I had a problem with alcohol. Whatever I sort of admitted I had a problem with alcohol, I don't know about you, but I got angry. But the day I surrendered, I got relief. You know, I went to psychologists, and I went to psychiatrists, and I went to psychologists one time, and I got to tell you, I'm going to give you this information free of charge. He charged me $100 for this, and I'm going to give it to you today free of charge. After about an hour, he told me I had low self-esteem. I said, "You know, I know that. You know, what do you want me to do about it?" He said, "Go buy yourself a nice suit of clothes and a shirt and tie." He said, "Dress up. Feel good about yourself." Sounded good to me. I went and got good and drunk, and I went to the clothing store, bought myself a new suit of clothes, new shoes, new shirt. Wrote the man a bad check, you know. Never went back to see the psychiatrist. It never made me feel better. I went to the doctor one time, and I said, "Doctor," I said, I feel bad all the time. I said, you know, that was after this other man told me I had low self-esteem. He said, "I can take care of that." He said, "I can give you some pills here to make you feel better about yourself." I said, "Doctor, how long does it take to work?" He said, 7 to 10 days. I said, "I don't need that. I got something in the front seat of the car that makes me feel better less than 7 minutes. So, you know, I'm not an ender. I'm not an ender. Thank God I never got into those pills. You know, I could have gone to see a veterinarian. Veterinarians are used to dealing with creatures. You know, can't tell them what the deal is, you know, because I'm going to lie to begin with. Maybe you can identify with this. My problem is always money. I always had financial problems. See, So never had enough. Never have enough money. See, with all the habits I had out there, you know, it took a lot of money, you know, gambling and women and running around and not being a responsible husband and a responsible member of society. So I had one. Maybe you had one. I call them a caretaker, enablers. And I just pick up the phone. I was living in Charlotte at the time, and I pick up the phone, and I call my mom. Now, my mom is a nurse in Clarendon County, South Carolina, and the height of her earning career, she makes between $10,000 and $11,000 a year. I pick up the phone and call Mom. I said, Mom, I'm going to be through town next week. Love to see you. Come on down, son. Love to have you. We sit in that little small white frame house that my mom was so proud of. And I'd sit there and I'd put the touch on my mom and I'd say, Mom, things are tough out there. I said, can you let me have $500? She'd say, $500, Bob, that's a lot of money. I said, come on, Mom, this time's going to be different. I'm going to pay you back. She'd write that check out, Bobby McKinney, $500. I'd stand in the doorway and I'd hug my mom and I'd tell her, I said, Mom, this time's going to be different. And I'd leave and I'd go to the Bank of Clarendon and I'd get that check cash. You know, Bootsy, who's not one of Bootsy Art, who's not one of us, she'd give me those big bills because you say I'm a big shot. And I'd take that money and I'd put it in my pocket and I'd go back to, on the way back to Charlotte. And it's because that guilt would just engulf me so much because, see, I knew that she knew I'd come down to put the touch on my mom. And on the way out of town, I'd stop and get that bottle of vodka and that Gatorade. And on the way back to Charlotte, I started doing one of the most dangerous things that I think we could do as alcoholics, as practicing alcoholics, and I start drinking and thinking. Because you see, when I start drinking and thinking, I'm making plans. See, I'm making plans about, you know, how I'm going to change. You know, how I'm going to be a better son to my mother. Yes, that's what I'm going to do. By God, I'm going to be a better son. I'm going to be a better husband to that wife. I'm going to go home on time, you know, on a daily basis. I'm going to be a better father to those kids. I'm going to change and I take another drink. Now, all of a sudden, man, I'm going to do all these changes, see. You know, I've heard a lot of alcoholics talk about how they were going to change before we got the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of them are usually drunk when we were going to change. And see, I'm getting drunk and I'm getting high and I'm changing, see. And two or three days later, I'd come to God knows where with God knows who, you know. All that money is gone. And I'd drag up to that mirror and I'd look like I'm 10 miles of worn out road. You know, and I'd finally find that bottle and I'd pull on it a couple of times and I'd walk up that mirror again and I said, you know, it ain't that bad. And then I'd pick up that phone and I'd run that cycle out. And, you know, I'd drink so much to where I'm coming apart at the seams and I'm coming apart. And I can't drink anymore because I'm so sick. And then I have to make that telephone call to her. And then I have to start singing that Alcoholics National Anthem. You know, honey, if you let me come back this time, I promise you it'll be different. Give me one more chance, sweetheart. Come on, I'll do anything. You know, I don't know what's wrong with me. I just got all this pressure on me. Give me one more chance. And I could feel the pain. I could feel the pain on the other end of that telephone, and I could see the tears in her eyes. And finally, she'd say those magic words, do you promise? I'll promise you anything. Because you see, two or three months later, I'm back on the phone. I'm calling my mom again. Mom, I'm going to be through Manning next week. Love to see you. Mom, $700? $1,200? $1,800? Mom, $3,000. The last con job I pulled on my mom, I lived in Atlanta, Georgia, and this was 1974. I pulled a con job on my mom for $7,000. And this time it's going to be different. I'm going to change. Let me tell you how it changed. My mom called me in July of 1981 and she asked me to come down to take care of her. Take care of her? Can you imagine wanting me to do something for her? Because see, she'd gone to Dr. King, who she'd worked for 30 years, and he'd put her in the hospital and she was having stomach problems. And to make a long story short, my mom suffered from another incurable disease and it was cancer. And the day before my mom left this life and went to that next life, I was sitting in that hospital room with her, and because they could not do anything for her because it advanced so fast, so quick, that they were putting her on heavy medication, and the only thing she could do was just sleep, to keep, and they were trying to keep the pain down. My mom came out of that deep sleep that afternoon, and I was sitting in that room. And she called me over to her bedside, and she took my hand between her two hands, and she looked up at me with all the love and the compassion that a mother could have for her only son. And she said, son, I know the end's near. She said, will you please just stay with me until it's over? Mom, you know I will. I'll be right here. I sat down in that chair. My mom slipped off in that sleep. See, I'm a real alcoholic. And the real alcoholics do what we have to do, and that's drink. Because let me tell you what I started doing. I said, you know, I can go out and have a couple of drinks and I can be back in here and I can look good. See, I like the definition in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it says that once I take a drink, then I no longer control how much I'm going to drink or my behavior. And the next morning at 6:30 a.m., I can hear that telephone ringing in that flea bag motel that I'd passed out. And that nurse says, you better get here or your mother's dead. And see, I couldn't even stay with my mom one day. Because, you see, I'm an alcoholic and I've crossed that line. And I got to do what alcoholics do, and that's drink. And that's drink. I become so mean and so arrogant, so self-centered and so hateful that I buried my mom the next day and I could not shed one tear. And that's why I allowed alcohol to take me. I abandoned my family shortly thereafter, a wife and two kids in Charlotte, North Carolina. Never forget this as long as I live. My 18-year-old daughter stood in that living room with tears coming down her eyes and she said, Dad, please get help. Please get help. See, the only help I need is in the front seat of that car because, you see, it's still doing its thing for me. I never could see what it did to me. And the beginning of the end came for me when I moved to Greenville, South Carolina. Opened the door over at Woodbridge Apartments one night, and there stood the most gorgeous, beautiful thing I'd ever laid my eyes on. She thought I was rich because I had a company car and I had a credit card, and I knew she was beautiful, and we just went out that night and fell in sick. I said, honey, no sense in us living apart. I said, this beautiful relationship. I said, you know, what I loved about it is she didn't care how much I drank, and I didn't care how much she drank. You know, I noticed that every time I drank, she drank. That gal could drink more beer than anybody I have ever seen in my life. I'm telling you, she's a little, low, skinny, good-looking gal, but by God, she can flat put some beer down. I can tell you that. She'd put it right on the corner of the table. I've seen her drink 18 beers and never get out of the seat. She can flat drink it, and I loved it. See, I thought, my God, God has answered my prayers. He's given me somebody that finally understands me, and I understand her. We move in together. She's got a four-year-old son by a previous marriage. His name's Rob. I don't like Rob. He doesn't like me because he's there. Norman Rockwell's got a great way of painting the American dream. A little house, picket fence, you know. I wonder what Norman Rockwell would paint if he could paint a picture of the disease of alcoholism. Because the next two or three years in this apartment that we moved into, it was something like this. Hello, boy, might get up in the morning, he'd come in, and I'd be passed out on the floor, and sometimes I'd be clothed, and sometimes I wouldn't. Hello, boy, saw me come in one Christmas, and I had blood all over me where I'd gotten in a fight, and he saw cops all around the parking lot. He seen me snatch cars, telephones out of the wall. He seen me throw furniture. He seen me run his mom up and down that parking lot outside of that apartment in a blackout and a drunken rage, yelling and screaming and carrying on like a madman. That little boy opened his room, opened his mom's bedroom one morning, and he caught me and his mom in a very compromising position, and you know what I'm talking about. Vulgarity was rampant in that household. I was drunk on a daily basis, and so was she. Now, let me tell you how 4-, 5-, and 6-year-old kids react to a picture up to the disease of alcoholism. I used to come to about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd lay there just trying to ward off that screaming madness that hits you, you know. And I could hear those blood-curdling screams coming from that little boy's room. And I'd run down his room, and I'd throw that door open. He'd be standing in the bed, and he'd take his fist. And he'd be swinging out wildly like he's trying to fight off an animal. Or he's in pain, and he's got that moanful cry like he's suffering, and somebody's going to hurt him, and somebody's going to catch him. Now, this didn't happen once a week. This didn't happen once a month. This happened almost on a daily basis. Now, if you don't believe anything I say up here today, believe this. You don't have to drink alcohol to suffer from alcoholism. You see, me and that kid suffering from the same disease, and it's called untreated alcoholism. The sad part about that story is that little boy has never had a drink before in his life. This goes on for 3 years. The end came for me. September of 1983. I'm drinking a gallon of alcohol on a daily basis. I get to the point in my life I can't get drunk and I can't get sober. I can remember the day on his 7th birthday, Lib, the lady I was living with, she left a note. She was a school teacher. She said, would you please go get him a birthday cake? Just get him a birthday cake. I'm going to take he and some of his friends over to a skating rink. She says, I don't want you there. Just go get a cake. Well, you know me. Judge me on my intentions, not my actions, right? I do what I normally do. I get drunk, I black out, and I pass out, and I come to about 8 or 9 o'clock that night, and there's a note on the kitchen counter that says, "Get out of our lives. You will never treat us this way again as long as we live. I want you out of here. I want you gone when I get back." Well, I'm not stupid. I know I'm in trouble, and I know I've done something. Now, Lib tells it better in her story, and I tell it mine because I don't remember. See, what happened, she came home. I'm in a blackout. She takes Rob. She goes down to a grocery store. I follow her in a blackout, and we have this gosh-awful fight in this grocery store, yelling and screaming and carrying on, and I'm crazy and I'm mad, and finally I get back and I passed out and I blacked out. But I knew that I was in trouble. And I knew, it's amazing how we can just bounce back and forth when we're in trouble. And all of a sudden I just had this vision, it's time for me to do something nice for this kid. Seventh birthday. Well, he always liked fire trucks. Well, I'm too drunk to go get him a fire truck, so I just thought of the next best thing. I dial 911. Called the Greenville Fire Department, told them, said, "Bring a truck over here, pick me up, and we're going to go out to skating rink, pick these half a dozen kids out, ride them around Greenville, blow the siren every now and then." And I said, "That's going to be my gift to this little boy on his seventh birthday." And I said, "Now, pardon me, if you do that for me, I'm going to write you a check for $1,000. And he got quiet, and I said, "This fool's going to do it." And he come back, and he told me what I could do with my $1,000, and I told him what he could do with his fire truck. And with that, I slammed the phone down. Now, I don't know why it did it for me, because I've done horrible, a lot of more horrible things than that, like the time one Christmas, I went to get a pack of cigarettes at Christmas Day and came back 3 weeks later. Now that upsets them, when you do things like that. I don't know why it did it for me, but I sat down in that room that morning, and it was like my whole life just flashed in front of me. Here I was, I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. I wanted to live and I wanted to die. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it describes my bottom best when it says that if we make alcohol the king, that one day we're going to have four visitors, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And we're going to know loneliness if you have. And I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I can tell you right now, God, in my understanding today, gave me the greatest gift. That night in September in 1983, that he had ever given this alcoholic. And that gift was total desperation. And for a fleeting moment, I had that moment of clarity. Maybe there's another way. Now, unlike Bill Wilson, I didn't see a light and the wind didn't blow in. But I had that moment of clarity. And I said, maybe there's another way. Long story short, Lib comes back. We make arrangements, and they had already been talking about me, and we know who they are. They brought me down to Peachwood Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, and they put me over in a room over there. And if you've never been to Peachwood Hospital, I can tell you there's a room over there that you do not want to visit. Because in that room, they put you in a bed, and they put you over in the corner. And when you try to get out of that bed, that room turns into a cliff with a big hole in it. And down the bottom of that hole, they got a lot of snakes. They got a lot of alligators. They got a lot of pink giraffes and purple monkeys. And they got spiders crawling around over in there. And every time you get on that cliff, somebody's trying to push you over. And that's where I resided for about a week or 10 days. And you know what I'm trying to describe to you? That was trying to get off that booze. They ain't got enough medicine, I can tell you that. Not enough vitamins, nothing. But I'm quick to recover 10 days out of that, and I'm over there with them. With them, those alcoholics. And I told a lady over there, I said, "If you'd had my problems, you'd have drank too." She said, "Nah, I don't think you got that many problems, hotshot." She says, "I just think you got situations that you created because of your alcoholic behavior. That's why you're here. You didn't come here because you sang too loud in the choir." Little redheaded doctor stood up in a meeting one day and he explained this horrible disease to me. When he talked about our character defects and he talked about my inability to process alcohol like normal people. And he talked about the main thing. He said, "This thing you got between your ears," he said, "you got the audacity to call it a brain." He said, "It's a crippled instrument." He said, "Because every day you'll get up and say today it's going to be different. You'll do the same thing that you did the day before." And then he set the hook. He set the hook for this alcoholic. He talked about God. And then all of a sudden he said, "Ladies and gentlemen," he says, "the ones of you sitting in this room," he says, "I can't tell you whether an alcoholic or not," he says, "but if you are," he said, "you need to make a decision before you leave here on how you're going to die, not live." And he got me. Because you see, I didn't want to die drunk. But then again, when I look back on that for 44 years of my life, I never lived. I existed. See, I was always running from something, never to something. See, I was always trying to get somewhere, and when I got there, I didn't know why I wanted to be there. See, I always felt inferior. I always felt less than. And when that man told me, he says, hey, if you want to die sober, he said, there's a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to recommend it to you. Now, I'd been to a stupid meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina about 2 years previous to that, and I didn't want to have nothing to do with you. Y'all weird. I walked in that meeting that night. All of you were in a corner over there. I had two big old silver pots over there. All of you looked grumpy and mean. Those lights went off. Y'all went and started pouring that brown stuff in that cup, started slopping it down. You started hugging each other, kissing each other, and carrying on. And the guy come running up to me, and he says, you want a cup? And I said, you better believe it, because I knew something was in it. You know? He told me, he says, welcome, friend, I love you. And I said, oh, Lord, I'm in the wrong place. See, I made fun of you when I got here, before I got here. But see, Alcoholics Anonymous is sort of like Delta Airlines. We ready when you are. Delta Airlines used to have that slogan. I'm laying up in that treatment center, taking everybody's inventory, and finally that doctor talked about a God of his understanding. And I don't know about the God of your understanding. I just know this. I don't know whether I've got a God of my understanding or not, but I got a God that understands me. And that's important for me, because that morning I went back to that room and I surrendered. And when I surrendered, I got relief. And I stayed in that treatment center for about another 2 or 3 weeks, whatever, 4 weeks. I can't remember. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in October of 1983, man, and I'm running wide open, see. I grabbed Live by one hand, and we go to 9,480 meetings the first year. And if they'd had Rookie of the Year, I'd have got it, man. Because I'm telling you, I'm wide open. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have a home group. But, you know, I'm in there running my mouth. You know, I didn't want to look at me, so I looked at you. And I remember I was just so sick. I told Liv one night on the meeting after, I said, honey, I said, do you think they understood me tonight when I was trying to explain humility to them? 14 months into this program, I'm sitting outside of a meeting, and old Jason, he comes up to me and he said, hi, Chad, how you doing? And of course, I lied and said, fine, and we all know what fine means. He said, why don't you go home and read chapter 5? I said, chapter 5? I said, Jason, they read it every meeting. They read it every meeting, and it went right over the top of my head. See, he said, Bob, he said, there's two kind of people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous, walkers and talkers. And he said, I've been to a lot of meetings, and he said, you one heck of a talker, Bob. I went home that night and found a big book, wiped the dust off of it, and read chapter 5. And you know what that first sentence says? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I don't know if something happened. Something happened. And that's when I made a mistake, and I got Sterling for a sponsor, and I say that in jest. And he took me through these steps. See? And he explained to me, he said, Bob, he said, it's the difference between convenience and commitment. He says, if you're going to be a commitment, he says, alcoholics will join anything. He says, you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you work these 12 steps, and you active in a home group. He says, you get there early, and you stay late, and you make coffee. He says, if you don't like to chair meetings, he said, chair meetings. He said, if you like to chair a meeting, do something you don't like to do. He said, give yourself the points on something you don't like to do. And I mean, you know, he took me through these steps. You know, he said, the first three steps are nothing but the giving up steps. He said, the next three steps, he said, they're the owning up steps. The next three steps are the payback steps, and the last three steps are the growing up steps. And he took me through these steps one at a time. And I can never forget one time, I said, Sterling, I said, you're a great sponsor. And I said, you've been so kind to me, and you've taken me through all these things. I said, I want to be a good sponsor. I said, how will I know if I'm a good sponsor? And he said, very simple. He said, if you're a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're a good sponsor, he says, your telephone's ringing. He said, if your telephone's not ringing, he says, maybe you ought to take a look at your program. I called home yesterday, and I hate to be honest, but you know, I checked my answering machine, and I didn't have a call on there. I need to take some inventory, you know. And you know, I just passed it off, because I can justify and rationalize everything. Oh, they knew I was out of town. You know? But I mean, the point being is, he took me through these steps. He told me why we took a fifth step. He said, Bob, when you take a fifth step and you share with me and God the exact nature of your wrongs, you have no longer secrets. You have no more secrets. And he said, you're going to stay as sick as your secrets. We got to those painful amend steps. I had to go back to Charlotte, North Carolina. I had to make amends to a lady who'd given me 20 years of her life. In our book, it says that 9 times out of 10, the unexpected will happen. And I got to tell you, the unexpected happened that day when I made amends to her. Because she looked at me and she says, "I'm going to forgive you, but I need to ask you one thing." And I said, "What's that?" She says, "Why couldn't you found God in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous while we still together?" And I lost it because I can't answer that. Why didn't you get here 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years earlier than you got here? And I carried that guilt with me for about 2 years. And finally in Johnson City, Tennessee, one night I sat down and I wrote her a letter. And I explained in detail all the horrible things I had done to she and those two kids. And I got on my knees and I said, "God, give me direction." I said, "I can't send her this mess." And God gave me the message, "No, you can't. You tear it up and forget it and you move on. You've done the best you could." I had to make amends to my mom. And I've had a lot of people to tell me that they've had a problem with this, making amends to someone that's passed on. And I can only tell you what's worked for me. One spring morning, I went down to where my mom's buried, and she's buried out in a beautiful little setting out in the country. And I went over to my mom's grave that morning, and I just stood there with God by my side, and I told Mom my story. What I was like, what had happened to me, and what I was trying to be like today. And I asked for that forgiveness. That's the easiest amend I've ever had to make. Because you see, there's a part in our book that says, deep down in every man, woman, and child, the fundamental idea of God exists. And it seems to me when I'm childlike, I'm closest to my God. And I knew that morning that I was childlike. And if I was childlike in the presence of God and my mom, I know without a shadow of a doubt, moms forgive little boys. And I walked off there free mind. And as a part of my amends to my mom, I send flowers to her church on Mother's Day. And I try to go by there once or twice a year and I talk to her. And I've been free of that. What's my life like today? Well, old boy back home says his life's fantastic, but nothing great ever happens, and I identify with that. So part in our book, it says that, you know, if our relationship with him, meaning God, is right, that great events will come to pass for me and countless others. And I'm just going to talk to you briefly about some of the great events that have happened in my life, and we're going to get out of here. That 18-year-old daughter that stood in that living room and begged me to get help is now 34 years old today. She's given me 2 grandchildren. It took her 9 years to forgive me. It took her 9 years for her to accept my amends. And 2 or 3 years ago, after the birth of my first grandchild, who's a little beautiful girl, name's Addie, and she and her husband visited us one Christmas, and we sat up late one night, and she looked over at us, and with tears coming down her eyes, she looked at me and Liv, and she says, "If anything ever happens to me and my husband, Andy, would you please take this child and raise him, because we want her to have the life that you do have." And she said, "This is not a tribute to you, Dad." She said, "This is a tribute to a program called Alcoholics Anonymous." 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was up in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I called her and I said, "You know, let me take your kids out to dinner." And so we went out to dinner. And it was me and my daughter and her husband and my 2 grandkids. And I got a 3.5-year-old granddaughter named Addie, and like I told you. And we got through eating, and it was a store behind the restaurant we was eating on. It was Toys R Us, and she calls it Toys for Us. And I said, "Well, come on, sweetheart." I said, "I'm going to take you over there and buy you a toy." And I said to my daughter, I said, "Can I do this?" And she said, "Yeah." So I took my daughter by the hand and we went outside and I put her in the driver's seat of the car and I strapped her in the driver's seat, the passenger side of the car, and I put her in and I strapped the seat belt down and I got in and I did the same thing in the driver's seat. And let me tell you why that's important, because I'm responsible today. Because when her mother was about that same age, I had her in the car one time and I stopped to get a chaser, and the guy at the service station says, "You're not driving anywhere with this child because you're too drunk." And I need to never forget that. And see, I'm being responsible, and I took that child and I strapped her in and we went over to Toys for Us, as she calls it. And we walking down the aisle hand in hand, and I'm going to buy her this toy. And I said, "Okay, sweetheart, Papa's going to buy you one toy because that's what Mom says you can have. And she tugged on my hand and she looked up and she says, but yes, Papa, but I want two. And I identified right there. I got another daughter. My daughter's name's Kelly. Kelly's 30 years old. And let me tell you what kind of relationship we have. By God's grace and the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, if she can make it to June this year, she'll have 7 continuous years in this fellowship. And I say thank you. She called me a couple of weeks ago and she said, Dad, are you and Lib going to be home this weekend? And I said, yeah. She said, can I just come over and hang out? I said, absolutely. So I knew something was bothering, and long story short, she came home, and you know, I didn't try to give her a lecture on relationships. I just listened. I just listened to her, and I let her go through the pain, and I just said, Dad loves you, whether you're in a relationship or not, sweetheart. It's okay. It's okay. See? And she's worked through it, and I'm so proud of her. And God bless her. And then there's Rob. Rob's 21 years old today. I got to tell you about Rob. He's my movie star. See, Rob was always one of these kids that was always a year behind the other kids, and he was always too small to play sports. He was always too skinny, and he was always too short. But now he's matured into a 6'1", 21-year-old beautiful guy. Beautiful guy. Beautiful kid. And I can remember that... I can tell you the miracle in his life today is that he doesn't have the nightmares anymore. They're gone by God's grace. God's taken those away from him. And I can remember he was about 10 years old and he was in the third or the fourth grade or whatever. He had to write a little story about what his life was like. And I was out of town and I'm in the me's, you know, poor me, you know. I love that analogy about the drunk and the dog, you know. You let both of them in the house and a few minutes later, the dog will quit whining, you know. And I get that way sometimes, you know. So I'm whining to Lib that night, you know, poor me. And she said, wait a minute. She said, I'm going to read something to you. She said, Rob had to write a paper and the teacher gave him an A+ on it. Let me tell you what he wrote. He had to write a little bit about what his life was like. He said, my name's Rob. And he said, I live in such and such an address. And he says, I try to play Little League baseball. And I try to play Little League football. And he says, I try to play Little League basketball. And he said, I got two cats. One of them's named Sneaky. One of them's named Ginger. He said, I like Sneaky the best. And he said, you know, my life is just real good today. And I'm happy. And he signed his name. And he put down that P.S. He said, the happiest day of my life is when my mom married Bob. And see, that was the kid that I didn't want when I married his mom. Because he wasn't mine, see. I didn't want him. Let me tell you about this kid. He's 21 years old. And let me tell you where his heart is. He could not wait to call home yesterday because he got his grades at Clemson. And he got 3 B's and 2 C's. And I might not mean nothing to you, but let me tell you something. Knowing where that kid's come from and where he is today, that is absolutely miraculous. Yeah. He tells me at least 3 times when I see him, I love you, Bob. I'm going to stop on the way back to Clemson today. Me and him are going to spend some time together. Time. The greatest gift that I can give my family, the greatest gift I can give anybody, is time. Bill left me a card in our room and it said, thank you, Bob, for giving us some time at the Marietta Roundup. Because see, when I give you time, I give you part of me. When you give me your time, you give me a part of you. That's what this whole deal's about. See? That's what this kid wants, is time. That's all. His mom, I made fun of it and I laughed and I said, you know, I've had 15 or 20 wives and I've only been married to two of them. Well, let me tell you something. I've slept with one woman for 15 years, and that's my beautiful wife, Lil. Yeah. She's an active member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I must point out that she's 2 weeks behind me in this fellowship. And she hates that with a passion. She will never get over that resentment. She has talked to her sponsor, but she will never get over it. 2 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we yelling and screaming at each other just like we did when we were drunk. So I'm going to leave her because it's her fault. So I go to my sponsor who knows everything about everything, right? I said, Sterling, I want her out. I said, I don't want to be with her. She's crazy. She's not working her program. She's not doing this. She's not doing that. Blah, 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 blah. He said, fine. He says, you can leave. He said, but do it the AA way. Oh, my God, the AA way. What is the AA way? He says, here's what I want you to do. He says, I want you to go home. I want you to talk to her. And I want you to suggest to her that y'all do prayer and meditation together in the morning. I said, Sterling, you got to be kidding. John Wayne wouldn't do that. He said, you ain't John Wayne. He says, you go home and you suggest that y'all do a prayer and meditation together. And he says, if you do that for 1 year, you come back, and if you still want to leave her, he says, I'll take you downtown and file papers with you. Hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life, other than surrender to the fact I was an alcoholic. I went home and I said, Lib, Sterling said, we need to do this. She said, do what? We got a book out the next morning and we read. She said a prayer and I said a prayer. About 2 or 3 months later, reading out the same book, a meditation book, she read, I read, we held hands, we prayed a little bit. 2 or 3 months later, we're reading out the same book. We hold hands and we slide on our knees. I'm proud to say from that moment to this moment, every time I'm in town, every morning, we get on our knees and we hold hands and we pray together the third step prayer. And if you think that sign that says people that pray together stay together is funny, I'm here to testify that it ain't funny. Because that is the foundation of our marriage. And as God is my witness, one of her sponsees came to me 2 days ago. She'd been married 7 years, been in program 8 years. Her husband's been in program 11 years. And she and her husband are separated. And she came to me and she said, Bob, the reason we're separated is 2 years ago we quit praying together. It's neat to be married to your best friend. And I love her like a rainbow. I'm a close now. And you know, I always, you know, most speakers always like to close with something fabulous, you know, so you can go home and all this wisdom and God, did you? You know. The only thing I can tell you is this. Today I drive a sober car. It's fully repossessable. It's in the parking lot out there. I get up and I go to work on a daily basis on Mondays to the same job. I come back to the same place during that day too, sometime the same day. That's a miracle. I wake up in the morning and I don't come to. You know, my mode of operation I used to be, I used to come to, use the bathroom, get out of bed. And today I wake up, get out of bed and use the restroom. We live in a sober home today. Let me tell you what a sober home is to me. The beds are made up and the floors are clean. Sober home is there's a lot of laughter there. There's a lot of love there. Yeah. Mother's one word and God has no last name in my house. Yeah. You see, when I got here, it had two names where I came from. Now, I don't know about the God of your understanding, but see, I have all of this because, you see, we talk about God and how we find God. And I go to an 11th step meeting every Sunday morning, and that's hope I was missed this morning when my wife was there. And you know, it says God as we understand Him, and we seek Him through conscious contact, through prayer and meditation. Now, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about my God. Let me tell you, when I have close conscious contact with my God, it's usually about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Because, see, I wake up, and it's quiet. It's quiet. And it's nobody there, and it's still. And my wife, my beautiful wife, is next to me. And if I can allow my mind to drift to a certain part in my soul, and if I can get quiet, there's a peace there, and there's a serenity there that I can't describe to you. But when I'm able to do that, that's the God of my understanding. And I slip back into that sleep. And that's been a gift that God has given me today. That lets me know that, hey, Bob, this ain't no big deal. If you make it a big deal, you put me before that. See? I don't try to hit home runs anymore, ladies and gentlemen. I just try to get on base. I let God take care of the stuff. And it's worked for me for 15 years almost. And I don't know what to say to you this morning. I don't know what to say to you except this. My prayers have become shorter as I've gotten sober. Because you see, I used to ask God for all of this stuff on a daily basis, and thank God he didn't give them to me. Oh, thank God he didn't give them to me. So sometimes my prayers go something like this in the morning. Show me. Just show me, God. And then at night, I slide on my knees. And I say that two-word prayer that I think is the greatest prayer that I've ever said in my life. Thank you. Thank you. And I say to you at the Marietta Roundup, thanks for sharing a little bit of your life with me this weekend. And hopefully I've shared a little bit of my life with you. And just maybe by God's grace, and the fellowship program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we can stay sober one more day. Good day, and God bless you. Thank you.